Imagine walking up to one of those wooden civic suggestion boxes, you know, the ones in your local town
Oh,
hall.
yeah, the classic locked box.
Right. So you have an idea, this really deeply personal, thoughtful proposal to fix like a critical piece of infrastructure in your neighborhood.
Okay, I'm with you.
You fold the paper, you drop it in the slot, and immediately from inside the box, you hear the unmistakable grinding sound of a paper shredder.
Wow. Yeah, that is an incredibly bleak visual.
It is, but we're constantly told by institutions that our input matters, right? That our voices are, you know, the lifeblood of democracy.
Absolutely, it's the standard pitch.
But the actual digital architecture we're given so often feels like it's designed to just swallow our input without leaving a single trace.
Yeah, and that visual of the shredder is precisely the tension we are looking at today in this deep dive.
Exactly. Okay, let's unpack this.
So we are examining a really fascinating firsthand reflection from the very first civic tech hackathon organized by the European Commission in Brussels.
Right, this was back on June 22nd and 23rd, 2026.
Correct. It was part of their wider Democracy Shield initiative. But what really stands out in this source material isn't like a triumphant announcement of some flawless, world-changing app.
No, not at all. It's almost the opposite.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
The author didn't leave Brussels with a finished product. They left with a set of hard requirements.
Which honestly is probably more useful than a victory lap.
Oh, 100%. It's a realization that the idealistic world of, civic tech often collides spectacularly with the messy reality of human behavior, time constraints, and just institutional default settings.
So before we even get into the specific code or the digital platforms they were trying to build over that weekend, we really have to understand the mindset of the person walking into that room.
Right, the author's perspective is key here.
They describe themselves as carrying this heavy conceptual load into a highly institutionalized space. And during the early mingling, they realized people were kind of reading them as some version of an anarchist.
And, that label wasn't necessarily thrown around as an insult.
No.
No, it was more of a social shorthand. Like the author was arriving from way outside the standard institutional track.
Right, they didn't have that typical Brussels polish.
Exactly. They were jumping straight into complex discussions about AI, structural power, societal architecture, all without first feeling out where the safe edge of the conversation was.
Yeah, they openly admit they haven't spent years internalizing the ordinary rhythm of Brussels committees or, you know, the Palat status games of professional group work.
They're essentially a systems thinker dropped into a room that expects standard professional compliance.
So they came to the event with several architectural concepts already in their bag, metaphorically speaking. Frameworks they called P4P, 24 doors, and windowsill.
Right, a lot of conceptual heavy lifting.
But the most impactful thing they brought was this thesis they called the work doctrine.
Oh, this part is brilliant.
It really is. The core of this doctrine tackles a massive blind spot in our current technological debate. They write that they're tired of the AI conversation being solely about AI taking our jobs.
Right, because the real issue is that AI is taking our hours.
Exactly. The fundamental question is who actually receives those hours back?
Which is such a potent reframing, Think about how effectively that specific sentence travels across different groups.
It completely changes the conversation.
Yeah. A union representative hears it as a labor and compensation issue. A policymaker hears, like, a macroeconomic measurement problem.
But a regular citizen just hears the simple, profound question underneath.
Exactly. If a massive technological shift creates a surplus of time, does human life actually absorb any of that surplus? Or does the system just capture it for further extraction?
I always look at this through the lens of inventing the washing machine.
Oh, that's a great comparison.
Right. When the washing machine was introduced, the promise was that the household would suddenly have all this unprecedented free time.
No more spending the whole day at the washboard.
Exactly. But society didn't actually give that time back to the individual. The baseline just shifted.
The standards changed.
Yeah, suddenly the societal expectation was that you must wash your clothes twice as often to maintain a new standard of cleanliness.
So the technology saved the hour, but the system absorbed the capacity.
Exactly. And the author is asking if AI is basically just the ultimate washing machine right now.
What's fascinating here is that this friction between the author's mindset and the system's expectations wasn't just theoretical. It played out physically at the hackathon.
Oh man, the cigarette break anecdote.
Yes.
It's so telling.
There's this brilliant moment where the author steps outside after the third presentation for a cigarette. They start talking to someone. The conversation gets deep.
One cigarette becomes three.
Right. And by the time they walk back inside, they've entirely missed the final presentation.
And the author frames that moment as a personal annoyance, right? They attribute it to their own ADHD and an inability to maintain what they call enthusiasm on schedule.
Yeah, because hackathons naturally demand that you sit in a room with 100 people for hours on end, paying rapt attention to a rigid sequence of events, regardless of how your body or mind is actually processing the environment.
I actually want to push back on their self-critique there, though.
Oh, how so?
Well, the author views that missed presentation as a lack of professional polish, like a personal failing. But I read that exact physical rebellion, that literal inability to sit quietly and conform to the room's scheduling format, as a necessary diagnostic lens.
That makes a lot of sense.
Right. It let them see the flaws in the hackathon structure itself. If they had just sat there politely playing the game, they wouldn't have noticed the artificiality of the format.
That discomfort is absolutely a diagnostic tool, and it maps perfectly onto the structural friction in the technology they were trying to build over the weekend.
Yeah, let's talk about the build, because hackathons naturally reward visible interfaces.
Right, they reward pitch clarity, clean demos, a catchy name, a shiny screen.
They're fundamentally designed to reward concepts that a jury can understand in 3 minutes of passive consumption.
Exactly. And the author was on a team that chose the incredibly honest battle cry, yes but no.
I love that name. So they built a project called Substance. It was a conversational interface, essentially a chatbot designed to help people move beyond surface level complaints and engage more deeply with civic issues.
And the author is very clear that this was good, solid work. I mean, building any functional interface in 2 days under pressure is a heavy lift.
Definitely. But here is where it gets really interesting.
Like the realization.
Yeah. The author starts to realize there's a massive, dangerous difference between an interface and an engine.
This raises an important question about algorithmic empathy. Because a conversational interface, by its very nature, performs listening.
Right. It simulates empathy.
It nods. It summarizes your input. It asks a polite follow-up question. But algorithmic empathy in a civic instrument is actually quite dangerous if it doesn't connect to a mechanical reality.
It's just a facade.
A democratic tool cannot just perform listening. It must structurally prove what it did with the input.
Yeah, you look at a standard chatbot and it operates on blind faith. It asks you to pour your civic grievances into a text box and just believe the system is going to do something about it.
Which is a huge ask for a citizen.
Right. So the author maps out a completely different chain of operations required for real democratic tech. Instead of just question, answer, and generated follow-up, the system has to operate with mechanical accountability.
It's a very specific sequence.
Yeah, they break it down. It goes answer, then summary, then confirmation. And the mechanics of that are vital.
Right. The system has to prove to the user, this is what I heard, did I get it right, before it even attempts to process the data.
Only after that explicit confirmation do you move to the next step, which is looking for a pattern.
And from there, extracting group meaning.
Exactly. And the author links this to a concept they've been developing called MindHive.
Right, which is essentially a tool designed to map group consensus without flattening the inevitable dissent.
It's about making group meaning readable without pretending everyone artificially agrees.
And the final step in that chain of operations is decision memory.
I really love that phrase, decision memory.
It's powerful.
Because if you don't have a verifiable route from a single citizen's voice all the way to a recognized systemic pattern, the interface is just a facade. It's digital theater.
A democratic system has to run on accountability. If the interface is just smiling at you while quietly discarding your data into a void, it actively erodes civic trust faster than having no tool at all.
So driven by what they describe as pressure, coffee, confusion, and ordinary stubbornness.
Great combination.
Right. The author decides that a shiny interface isn't enough. So they stay up late and build a parallel night prototype.
Now, this wasn't a rival to their team's main project, right?
No. It was tackling the same underlying problem from a completely different mechanical angle. And this prototype was ugly.
Like visually ugly.
Yeah, it wouldn't win a pitch competition because it abandoned the idea of chat entirely. Instead, it focused on a mechanism called directed listening.
And this introduces the most vital concept in the entire text, which is the participation receipt.
Yes. The participation receipt is a revolutionary requirement for civic architecture.
The author's argument is that if a democratic system asks people for their time and input, it cannot treat that input as raw, disposable content.
Exactly. The participant must be issued a verifiable receipt showing exactly how their input was received.
How it was mathematically or linguistically categorized.
What larger pattern it joined or resisted.
And crucially, what the next actionable step is.
It's so common to compare this to e-commerce. Like, you buy a pair of socks, you get a tracking number, you know exactly what warehouse your package is in.
Right. We expect basic transactional transparency from a shoe store.
But let's elevate that. In a democracy, the stakes are vastly higher than a missing pair of socks.
Slightly higher, yeah.
If a government tool acts as what the author calls a polite extraction layer, taking our thoughts and our data without issuing a receipt, that isn't civic engagement.
No, that is just data harvesting wearing a democratic mask.
Exactly. Without a cryptographic or verifiable proof of participation, you are just feeding a dashboard that you have no control over.
And the author realized that to prove this concept of the receipt actually worked, they couldn't just talk about it abstractly.
They had to build it.
They had to test it mechanically in the physical room they were standing in, basically prototyping the room with the room itself.
Because if your tool can't prove it works on 100 people sitting in a hackathon, you have absolutely no business deploying it on a city of 1 million people.
It just won't scale.
Right. So they developed this backup idea. They put a massive QR code on the presentation screen.
Okay.
They ask the room a low-risk, harmless question like rating the hackathon food or the venue.
Smart.
And then 2 minutes later, they show the mathematical pattern of those answers back to the room on the screen immediately.
So it's a live demonstration of behavior.
Exactly. Issuing the receipt in real time. They later built this out as a hackathon food pulse demo using a tool called DeepAsk.
Right. DeepAsk, which is designed precisely to probe an audience deeply and reflect that data back instantly.
Speaking of the food and the venue, there's a highly specific detail the author includes here.
Oh, the drinks on the table.
Yes. It might seem mundane at first glance, but it actually carries massive structural weight.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it really does.
They note the physical infrastructure of the room itself. The hackathon venue served Coca-Cola products, but the author went out of their way to drink a Fritz Cola instead.
Now, they clarify this wasn't some grand, performative political protest, right?
Right. They simply liked the taste of Fritz Cola better.
But you look at that Coca-Cola detail, and at first it seems, I don't know, petty to include in a serious write-up.
But it's actually a brilliant litmus test for procurement policy.
Exactly. Procurement is a language, and the menu is a map.
That's a great way to put it.
The European Union talks constantly about strengthening its own markets, building its own public infrastructure, fostering European technological sovereignty.
Yet, in a European Commission's civic tech room, a space specifically designed to imagine better localized democratic infrastructure, the default choice for catering is a massive global monopoly.
It's not about Coca-Cola being an evil empire. It's about how the boring default choices reveal the tree architecture of our institutions.
Right. If you want to talk about European plurality and localized infrastructure, why not have one soft drink from each EU country on the table?
Oh, that would be amazing.
Make the catering table a tiny physical market map.
Yeah.
Then you aren't just giving high-minded speeches about competitiveness. You are forcing the room to taste it, to count it.
To physically interact with what happens when the default choice isn't automatically made for them.
Because if institutions won't design the boring choices, like what gets bought for the buffet, they aren't truly designing infrastructure.
And that observation about the physical environment led the author to notice a massive structural gap in the event itself.
The missing role.
Right. We've mapped the gaps in the software and the gaps in the catering procurement. But there was a glaring human role missing from the architecture of this hackathon.
Because hackathons are heavily staffed, right? You have organizers, mentors, coders, juries, PR people.
A huge support system.
But the author realized a civic tech room desperately needs a role they call a floor reader or a civic tech pre-flight steward.
We need somebody whose entire job is to walk around the room before a single line of code is finalized, before the pitch decks are polished.
Just to ask the hard, uncomfortable structural questions.
Exactly. They need to ask, what is the actual motor behind this interface? Are you just simulating empathy, or is there an engine?
What are the data risks here?
Who actually owns this intellectual property after the weekend is over?
What tangible proof would a citizen receive back?
Because once the room shifts into demo mode, critical thinking is entirely suspended in favor of presentation speed.
The window for structural critique just completely closes.
And the consequences of lacking that structural memory became painfully obvious the moment the event ended.
Oh, this part is just tragic. The author goes home, sits down at their computer, and tries to find the public record of this hackathon they just spent days participating in.
And what is the only durable public trace they can find?
A single participant's LinkedIn post.
It's a total collapse of institutional memory.
Completely.
The only public archive of a European Commission civic tech event lived in one person's feed on a closed, algorithmically driven corporate platform.
You couldn't find the decisions, the failed prototypes, the disagreements, or the structural outcomes on the open web.
The room happened, but the room vanished.
The irony is staggering. Isn't it just a massive irony that an event literally tied to the Democracy Shield initiative, an initiative meant to protect civic discourse, has to rely on a corporate social media platform just to prove it existed?
It really is.
If there is no institutional memory surface, participating in these events is like writing complex legal codes in the sand right before high tide.
Now, the author is careful to qualify this systemic critique, though. They make a point to separate the broken architecture of the event from the genuine effort of the individuals inside it.
Right, we have to acknowledge that distinction. The author specifically names the people who made those days matter.
The people who gave their energy and patience to the work.
Exactly. Let me actually read the names because it's important. People like Ellen Gabriel Grimskew, Cruz G, Katja Hermes, David Kanat, Hendrik Nahr, and Duarte Silva.
And the author explicitly notes that naming them isn't an endorsement of the flawed system they were operating within.
No, it's an acknowledgement of reality. Real people tried to forge something meaningful inside a format that was actively fighting them.
Which brings us to the final distillation of what the author actually gained from Brussels.
The four pillars.
Right. They didn't walk away with a product. They walked away with four absolute necessities for civic tech, which they are now mapping to specific protocols and tools.
So first is voice, right?
Yes. Voice is the mechanical ability to listen one person deeper, which is the function of that DeepAsk tool.
Okay, got it. And second is pattern.
Exactly. Pattern is the ability to make group meaning readable without forcing artificial consensus,
right,
which is handled by the mind hive concept.
Right. And third is the receipt.
Generating verifiable proof of what happened to a citizen's input.
And finally, fourth is memory.
Right. Ensuring the conversation survives contact with time. They link this to a protocol called Lineage, which is designed to track the history of a civic decision long after the initial input is given.
Voice, pattern, receipt, memory.
If you're missing even one of those four pillars, you are not building civic tech.
So what does this all mean for you? Because we all interact with these digital civic platforms.
All the time.
We submit forms, we offer feedback to our municipalities, we participate in public consultations, we are constantly feeding the machine. But let me take this a step further and leave you with something to really chew on. We spend so much time worrying about AI simulating empathy in chatbots, or algorithms swallowing our feedback without a receipt.
Which are valid concerns.
Definitely. But what happens in the very near future when the AI models become so integrated into our civic architecture that they aren't just generating the policies?
Uh-oh.
What if they are also generating the synthetic citizen consensus to support those policies?
Wow. Yeah, that's a terrifying thought.
Right. If we don't demand hard mechanical recites for human participation right now, how long until our democratic tools become nothing more than highly efficient simulation engines?
Generating the illusion of consent.
Exactly. Generating the illusion of consent without ever needing a real citizen to drive a piece of paper in the box.
It completely cuts the human out of the loop.
So next time an institution asks for your input, don't just ask where it goes, ask for the receipt. Until next time, keep diving deep.